June 19, 2012, the Lamrim Meditation class. We're going through the graded stages of how we develop ourselves along the Buddhist path to aim for increasingly vaster goals. And we saw that these goals build one on top of the other. First, to turn our main focus away from this lifetime, and to aim for improving future lives, and particularly to continue to have a precious human rebirth so that we can continue on the path. And then thinking about all the sufferings of any type of rebirth that we might have, even a better state, then developing renunciation for that and striving for liberation. And then the advanced scope, to see that even if we gain liberation, we haven't fulfilled our own purposes, and we certainly haven't filled the purposes of others, and we are completely interrelated and dependent on everyone else. And so we aim for the enlightened state of a Buddha so we can best help everyone. And we went through all the details of these levels of motivation. We've repeated it over and over again in each class, so maybe we can skip going through all the details of that and just continue where we left off. We have recently gone through the teachings for developing bodhicitta aim. We saw that this aim is very, very vast. It's aimed at all beings, not just a few. And we are aiming to help them to overcome all sufferings, to gain liberation from samsara, and to eventually lead them to enlightenment as well. There were two major methods that we discussed of how to get ourselves, or work ourselves up to this aim. The seven-part cause and effect meditation, based on seeing everybody as having been our mother, and the equalizing and exchanging of self with others. And last time we reached the point once again of developing bodhicitta, and we saw that this is a state of mind which is brought on and helped by love and compassion. Wish for others to be have happiness, and the causes of happiness, be free of suffering and the causes of suffering, taking responsibility to actually help them to achieve this, and with a total conviction that we actually are going to strive to do this. And then we focus on our not yet happening enlightenment, which can happen on the basis of Buddha nature, a lot of hard work, and based on the purity of the mind. And we have this very, very strong intention that I absolutely am going to achieve this, not just that I want to, but I'm definitely going to do it, and I'm definitely doing this in order to benefit everybody. So that was bodhicitta. Then the next part of the outline is actually involved with taking the bodhisattva vows. And for this, we have two states of bodhicitta. One is the aspiring state, or wishing state, in which we set our intention to achieve the enlightened state of a Buddha. And then the engaged state, in which we actually are going to engage ourselves into the conduct that will bring us there, which involves taking the bodhisattva vows. For the wishing state or aspiring state, there's the merely aspiring state, and then the so-called pledged aspiring state, in which we pledge that we're never going to turn back from this goal. And even with the wishing state or aspiring state of bodhicitta, there is a ceremony, a ritual, with which we can actually formally dedicate ourselves to this goal. And then, of course, there's the ritual for taking the Bodhisattva vows. And then Tsongkhapa's Lamrim Chamo, the great presentation of the greatest stages of the path, he explains about this ritual. There's no need to go into great detail about that, but basically, it's you have to set up a special place and bring a lot of offerings and wash before you go to this ritual, and then you repeat certain verses after the seven-part practice, the seven-limb puja. And Tsongkhapa makes a big point that it's necessary to do that seven-part puja before actually developing bodhicitta. It's necessary to build up some positive force. So that's refuge and offerings, openly admitting to the negative things we've done, admitting they were mistakes, and purifying, applying some opponent forces, and fourth, rejoicing in the happiness of others, and the positive things that they've done, the positive things that we've done, and then requesting the Buddhas to teach, requesting them not to pass away, and then dedication, this seven-part practice, very, very essential, very basic in all our practices. And then there is the ritual for taking the vows as well. And there are two traditions for taking these vows. One is with a spiritual teacher who is present, and one is just visualizing the spiritual teacher. So there are these two ways. Anyway, what we had decided that we would do is not go through each of the vows separately. I've taught that several times before. It's on my website. We went through it, I think, in detail in Nagarjuna's letter to a friend. And I have a big course on that that I gave in Moscow. But to just go through the vows, to list them, and hopefully you took a look at these before coming to class. And if you have any questions or points that you'd like to discuss, do that. So, when we develop the aspiring state of bodhicitta, you know, that actual wish, this is, you know, I am aiming for this not yet attained enlightenment, my own personal one, then there are various, and we develop the state that I'm never going to turn back from that. Then we have various points, five types of trainings that we promise to follow. I mean, it's a very interesting point here that we say that I'm never going to give up bodhicitta, even at the cost of my life, which is a very interesting point to really think about. That how seriously would we take that and consider that? There are situations, you know, for those who are listening to this on the internet, we're here in Germany. And so in Germany, you have the situation in the time of the Third Reich that you join the Nazi army or they shoot you. This type of thing. And they maybe shoot your family as well. So if we were actually in that situation in which your life is at stake, and perhaps your family as well, you stick to your moral principles. Now, with bodhicitta, it's not as though, you know, giving it up means that you go out and you kill people. It's much more a mental state. But it's a very interesting point. You know, are we willing to, would you be willing to die for your moral principles? I don't know. That's a very hard one, isn't it?
It doesn't make sense. It's a question.
Does it make sense?
To die for, then you said it's a mental state.
No, I mean, for bodhicitta, it's a mental state.
Yeah, that's what I,
Let's do the two separately.
Okay.
One is, let's say this thing, join the army or it will shoot you.
Mm-hmm.
This type of thing, what would you do? And this, of course, is a very individual choice, isn't it? Very individual thing. I don't think that there, you know, one can say, well, yes, you should, you know, be willing to be shot. Can't really tell anybody that. But it's something to think about. So why don't we think about that for a moment? What would you actually do? You see, in America, during the Vietnam War, you could go to Canada if you didn't want to go into the army. So you could flee and not come back to America. And going to Canada is not so, you know, that's such a big hardship. It's not like going to some, you know, barbaric, underdeveloped place. But at the time of Nazi Germany, there wasn't much of a choice. So what do you do? It's not like Russia, where you could bribe, basically, to get out of the army. Can you speak louder? I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
With the karma, the karmic situation.
Well, what is your karmic situation? What, thinking of the consequences?
Yeah, but also the circumstances also in this moment. I mean,
well, you could say the circumstances of this moment have brought me, because of karma, to this point of having to make a decision.
Yeah.
Now it's your decision. What do you choose? Yeah.
Yes, the question is, would you put your life at stake for your moral principles?
Right, would you put your life at stake for your moral principles is the question.
What comes up with me is, if you turn it into negation, you know, what is it really that you would put your life at stake for? I think, you know, there's not much that you would willingly, you know, not like abort or something like that, but you wouldn't go into that, you know, willingly to kill yourself, you know, like bungee jumping and stuff like that.
Right.
But for something that you would willingly take on the risk of your life, just maybe everybody has to consider what would you really consider so important. And I
for attachment.
Maybe people would arrive more easily at the...
So, I mean, what he's saying is that what is it that you would be willing to... There's a difference between put your life at risk,
yeah,
and or willingly give up your life.
Yeah.
To willingly give up, you know, to willingly risk your life, I mean, just for a sport, you know, like extreme sports and so on, that one has to think in terms of one's motivation. And is there some naivety there that you think that you're Superman or Superwoman and you're not going to die? But the other situation is, would you go and work in a super violent area? I'm thinking of the Japanese priest, Terasawa. Terasawa-san is with the Nichiren order, and he goes around with a whole bunch of followers, a lot of them from Kazakhstan and Ukraine, and they go to various places where there is conflict, and they go with their drums chanting, you know, the Nichiren mantra. And they did this in Chechnya, you know, going to the front lines where there was all this civil war, and they've done this many other places. So here you're putting your life at risk. Would you do that? I mean, this is, you know, putting your life at risk for some moral principle, you know, as a peacekeeper. Or to try to bring about peace.
Can you speak more deeply about moral principles?
Pardon? So this is on a moral principle that...
For peace. Or for protecting the life also?
Right. Well, peace means protecting the lives of the people who would be killed in the war zone. So would you be willing to do that? Or jump into a burning building to save somebody? I mean, this is going a little bit far-fetched from... our point here about not giving up bodhicitta, even though at the cost of our life. Yeah.
But jumping into a building, that would be on the basis of moral principle as well.
Right, jumping into a building is on the basis of moral principle as well, correct.
But my idea, what came up with me was, you know, if you turn it into the negative, this question, you know, what is it really that you would put your life at stake for? And if you about all the stuff where you are, you know, with certain emotions, attachments, stuff like that, or you're just, you know, ignorant of the risks of bungee jumping. If you just rule that out, and you, what are you left with? And I think most stuff will be connected to your moral ideas, like going to a house on fire and helping.
Well, your moral ideas, or people are willing to sacrifice their lives or put their lives in risk out of patriotism for their country. A lot of people join the army because of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they believe it.
And they believe it, of course.
They must believe it.
Right. So that's a very strong...
also stupidity.
Well, stupidity was, you know, doing that, that was the example of doing extreme sports that, you know, you could die in just because of, what should we say, naivety, thinking that you won't get hurt.
I have been very stupid doing things which I now regret, because mm-hmm. it has no fundamental base or something like this. For example, when I walk my country in war.
When you what?
I walk 2,000 kilometers for peace in my in a place which is a red zone, with full of bombs and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I realize now this is really stupid. It was a stupid action that I did, and I just did it because of the arts.
Right.
Art.
So here's for those that didn't listen to this. This is a woman, an artist from Colombia, who walked 2,000 kilometers in a complete drug war zone in Colombia. And now she realizes that she did it for a completely stupid reason, for, you know, as an artistic statement rather than actually for a moral principle.
But for peace.
But with the idea that it was for peace, but what you're saying is that your motive was not proper, and therefore she thinks that it is, that it was a foolish act. Well, did it accomplish anything?
But I did.
Did it accomplish anything? Because what I'm thinking of is that one should not regret anything positive that one has done.
No, I think I was wanted to. The project was you can still.
Right. The project was that you could still walk in Colombia. Well, the venerable what was his name? Head of Cambodian. No, the head of Cambodian Buddhism. What was his name? I knew him. I met him several times. Anyway, I can't think of his name. He's already passed away. But he did a similar thing in Cambodia.
But he was a Buddhist.
He was a Buddhist monk. He led a group of Buddhist, of Buddhists to walk through Cambodia, where all the minefields were and stuff like that, just to demonstrate for peace.
Yes, but I didn't do it from the point of view of him. Buddhist philosophy, like, did it for art.
Right, so she said she didn't do it for Buddhist philosophy, but for art. But anyway, let us think in terms of what does it mean to say, you know, as you said, what would you be willing to die for? So you could be willing to die for your country, you could be willing to die to protect your family, for example. There are many, you know, your loved ones, this sort of thing, but here it's saying that you'd be willing to die to keep your bodhicitta. So how in the world would that, what would that mean? I think what it means is that, I mean, nobody can force you to give up bodhicitta. I mean, you can say the words, you know, I give it up, but without meaning it. But let's say you are being tortured and everybody around you is, you know, just being absolutely horrible, like in the, you know, some of these concentration camps that still go on. And at that point, do you give up all this, you know, do you get totally discouraged and say, you know, it's not worth it, I can't? I think this is the type of situation that it's referring to, isn't it?
But then, like, one is in the situation that, for example, that one even think of taking one's own life, yeah, because it's so, like lots of monks did, would do in Chinese concentration camps. So So because they couldn't bear the everyday torture anymore, it couldn't be much worse, yeah.
Right, so there are some people who commit suicide, let's say, in these Chinese concentration camps, some monks, because they couldn't take it. You're saying, but then, of course, there are the self-immolations, you know, the monks who burn themselves as a protest. Mm-hmm. So this is, they're not giving up bodhicitta. You know, so even if your body is on fire, you're not going to give it up. Now, the example that comes to mind is that His Holiness always gives this example of one monk who was in a Chinese concentration camp for 20 years and tortured and all of that. And he said that there was one time, you know, where it was really, really dangerous and awful. And His Holiness said, you know, asked him, what was that? He said, you know, there was one time when I almost lost my compassion for the Chinese. So this is it. Can you continue even in that situation and not lose your compassion, let alone, you know, bodhicitta? So this is what it's saying. So this is a very, very strong commitment, isn't it? You know, and how strong would it actually be? I mean, it's hard to imagine having that strong a commitment, isn't it?
This is only possible if you really understand emptiness.
It's only possible if you really understand voidness.
Yeah, I don't know what this is, but...
Right. It would only be possible if you really understand voidness, or at least have some taste of that. Otherwise, you solidify, you know, the person that's torturing you, and, you know, this is the most horrible person in the world, and then you identify the person with what they're doing, and me, 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 and you get very angry.
This is what I was thinking, that exactly in the moment when you say this is a bad person and I hate them, in that moment you are losing them.
Right. As soon as you say, you know, this is a bad person and I hate them, then I'm not going to work for their sake.
They don't deserve anything.
You know, they don't deserve anything. You know, they should go to hell.
Yeah.
Type of thing. Yeah. Then you've blown it. Then you've lost it. So try to imagine, you know, when we talk about the wishing state of bodhicitta, let alone the engaged state, how strong a commitment is that? You know, a lot of people take bodhisattva vows and so on, but they just repeat the words. How sincere is it? And are we actually capable of making such a commitment? And then, well, then think about that, because then when it talks about the benefits, you know, of how incredible it is to develop bodhicitta, it starts to make sense. If you have that strong of a commitment, and you have it all the time, you know, what's called unlabored bodhicitta, you don't have to work yourself up to it, it's there all the time, as that's what I'm doing with my life. There's no question about it. No doubt whatsoever. Well, no ego, but it's this thing that I'm definitely going to do it. So you're convinced that you can do it. I don't care how long it takes, 3 countless eons, I'm going to do it. So think about that.
Self.
Pardon?
If you change yourself, yes, you change yourself, you are already committed on this will to change everything.
Right, so you are willing to change
yourself or something like this,
right.
You really, this commitment just to change and to really be completely...
like a bodhisattva.
Yes.
Right.
And then you start. And then maybe from this point of view, then if you have this, then you really can even give your life.
Right. So this is what she's saying, that if we really, really have this commitment, the commitment is to change. Certainly to give up being selfish and self-centered and working for my own benefit and so on. But keeping in mind Shanti Deva's thing, if the servant does his or her work, you feed the servant. You know, it's not that you neglect taking care of yourself, but then you're willing to do anything. So think how, and you know, then this is the commitment that you would not turn back. So think in terms of, am I actually able to do that in taking the bodhisattva vows? You know, if we've taken the bodhisattva vows, how serious was I? Oh, this is a nice idea. That's one thing. But to do the real thing, like it's speaking about in the text, then all these practices that it says for, you know, that's coming Next, you know, what are the trainings? The trainings are for it to not weaken. So you have to have it quite strong for it to not get weak. You know, to start with it not being weak is not the point. I mean, to start with it being weak is not the point. And think about this point of commitment. That was this exceptional resolve. The step right before bodhicitta, I definitely will do it. Okay. Now, I don't mean by this that without that full commitment, that it's not beneficial to try to, you know, to say I've taken the bodhisattva vows and to try to follow the vows and the discipline and all of that. This is excellent training. But don't think that you've developed the real thing. Sort of a light version of it. That there's a lot more work to do before it really becomes effective. You know,
To come back to this phrase, you have to not give up bodhicitta at the cost of your life. Do you think it's not meant it's more like not giving up bodhicitta under every circumstances, but that's one point in the bodhisattva vows. So I wonder that the statement, what has it to do with giving up the life?
So his question is, when we say I'm not going to give it up even at the cost of my life, do we take that literally? I think it means no matter what, even if it's the extreme of giving up my life. So it's for any reason, all the way up to what would be the most extreme, would be that that we lose our life. Because mind you, when you take bodhisattva vows, it is all the way up to enlightenment. It's not like the pratimoksha vows, the monk or nun or lay vows, that you lose at the time of death. This is something which continues. Now, how it continues, I've never been able to get a very clear answer for that in on the sutra prasangika level. But anyway, we will leave that. I really don't know. I think that because the vows are a subtle form, a non-revealing form, so that non-revealing form probably has to go to potential that continues from one lifetime to another and then manifests again in next lifetime. So that means even if you're born as a cockroach, you still have the bodhisattva vows, but they're not active. Now, I've asked that, you know, what happens? You take the bodhisattva vows and it's still enlightenment, and then you get a lower rebirth. So then what? Do you still have the bodhisattva vows? And what happens as a baby? Even if you have a precious human rebirth and you break the bodhisattva, you know, you violate them as a baby because you're a baby, you're a small child. And so they would say that you know, the vows have to be, in a sense, they're there, but they're not quite activated until you reaffirm them in the next lifetime. But the basis is there. Now, this is not the easiest thing to understand of how that actually works. But anyway, as I said, I haven't been able to get detailed teachings on that. Now, what would be necessary in order to have that commitment? That I'm not going to give it up even at the cost of my life. That I'm definitely going to do it. What would be necessary? What would you have to have as a state of mind to be able to have that commitment?
Firm conviction in future lives.
Firm conviction in future lives, yes, that's one thing.
And a very big, large mind at one. Thinking in a broader...
Right, and a very, very broad mind. A Mahayana mind, as they say. That can think in terms of such a vast goal for a vast number of beings, and so on. But what else? What is most fundamental here would be conviction that it is possible to attain enlightenment. If you're not totally convinced that it's possible to attain enlightenment, how could you be totally committed to trying to attain it? And not only is it possible, but I am capable of doing it. It's possible for me, not just Buddha Shakyamuni. And these are tough ones. Plus, conviction in knowing how to attain it, that there is a way of attaining it. So you know what to do. Wouldn't that be necessary? If you knew that, I mean, think of a, I mean, they always use a simple example, like you want to go somewhere. Let's say you want to go to India. You have to know that it's possible to go there, right? That I'm capable of going there. I can get time off from work. I can get the visa. I can get the money. And you know how to get there, what you have to do in order to get there. Buy a ticket or, you know, however it is that you're going to get there. And it's only when you are completely confident about all of that, now I'm going to India, that you can say that and feel confident.
One could also think, from my example, that I will try to go to India, yeah, and then one just walks out the door, you know, has the credit card in the pocket or even not, and then one just walks the direction and hitchhike, whatever, and one tries to come to India. And maybe one arrives in India one day, maybe not.
Okay, so this is a very good thing. He says, what about having the attitude that I will try to get to India, and you just go out and start hitchhiking. Maybe you have a credit card. A lot of hippies in the old hippie days didn't have a credit card. They just went out. And I'm going to try to get there. Is that analogous? When you take the bodhisattva vows, I'm going to try to do it. I don't know if I can do it. I don't know if it's possible. But I'll try.
Do it.
So you do it. I think that that's much weaker.
Yeah, it's, I mean, very unpleasant. I don't know the English word for it, but it seems to be very confused.
It's very confused because it's very easy to give that up if you fail, if you get hardship along the way. Oh, it wasn't possible. And then you give up.
I have done it. I have traveled all Europe with 1 euro. Completely, with hitchhiking, with everything, and...
Right, so our friends from Colombia who walked through...
And I'm here.
Walked through all that violence. She was capable of hitchhiking around Europe with only one euro. But stay on the point. What is the point
the
here?
The point is here that, for example, there is one with completely... understanding and consciousness, and the other like me, without just I did, but I don't have this this mind that I will get problem, that I will go this, that I will get problem. You know, I don't have this, but I did. I just
okay.
Do it
so she's
thinking,
right. So she says that when she made a trip like this, that she just did it without thinking, without worrying about the problems or anything. Just do it. But we're talking about the difference here, I mean, between doing it that style, I will try to reach a destination. You don't know if I can get there or not, but I'm going to try to do that. And having conviction that it is possible, and I am capable, and I have a good idea of what I need to do in order to get there.
If you believe in this enlightenment,
yeah, but if you believe in enlightenment, listen to what you're saying. If you
believe in this enlightenment.
Yes, but if you believe in enlightenment, that means that you believe that it's possible to attain, and then you're going to try to attain it. That's different between I don't know whether it is possible or not, but I'm going to go in that direction. Those are different. You know, I'm going to try to find Shangri-La. I'm going to try to find, you know, Cortez, the Golden City in Florida. I don't know if it exists or not. I'm going to try to find it. That's very different.
But one could try to become as much possible of help to all beings
right.
with this aim. But one doesn't know exactly how is it listed in the, you know, in the scriptures, you know, Buddha, you know, knows this and that, and he can, is everywhere simultaneously and manifests and so forth. If one is not convinced in this, I think one can still go in this direction.
Right, so one could still go in this direction, he says, without knowing all the qualities of a Buddha or being convinced that it's possible. Well, in the Lam Rim, it disagrees with that. It says that one needs to have a clear idea of what Buddhahood is like in order to aim for it. Otherwise, what are you aiming for? You're aiming to be God. You're aiming to be... What are you aiming to be? So, of course, one could aim to try to be of as great a help to everyone, to as large a number of beings as possible. And I will do that by overcoming being selfish and so on. I mean, you can do that. People do this on the basis of other religions besides Buddhism.
Say, do it on the scriptures, on the Buddhist.
Right. Okay. We do it in the right. But we are saying here, what is our point here? The point is the difference between doing that, doing it in that way, and doing it with bodhicitta, the way that it is described in the text. And to do it, you know, the way that it's described in the text is much stronger, has much more conviction. And when, you know, if we ever get to it today, maybe not at this rate, what are the various practices for not having it diminish, for not losing it in future lives, you know, not have it weaken, and so on, it will make sense, especially the first one, which is to remember every day the benefits of developing bodhicitta. Well, we're talking about the benefits of the real thing. There are, of course, benefits of I'm going to try to help as many people as possible and do it in a Buddhist way. There's certainly benefits of that, but the benefits that they're talking about are much stronger than that. So, this is my point. In other words, don't trivialize bodhicitta. Just as I made quite a big point in the past about don't trivialize refuge into just, you know, reciting some words and having a piece of hair cut, and then you get a Buddhist name, and that's it. That putting this direction in one's life, taking refuge, is a very, very major step, a big change in one's attitude toward what you're doing with your life. That to really develop bodhicitta, to really then, on the basis of that, take the vows, is quite something. And again, I have to repeat, you know, of course you can do it in a lighter version, and the lighter version has benefits. But the real thing is something else. The real thing is very, very strong. So, we have these five trainings. The first four are for being able to maintain and not weaken our bodhicitta, this pledged state of bodhicitta, that I'm never going to give it up. The four are to maintain it and not weaken, and then the fifth one is to not separate from it in future lives. So I'll just read them. We didn't want to go through a big discussion of these. So, to maintain it and not have it weaken in this lifetime. First one, each day and night we remind ourselves of the benefits or the advantages of having a bodhicitta motivation. These are quite incredible benefits if you read about them in the text that they talk about. Second, we reaffirm and strengthen this motivation by rededicating our hearts to enlightenment and others 3 times each day and 3 times each night. So remind yourself. Remind yourself of the benefits. Remind yourself of these vows. Third, we strive to build up these networks of positive force and deep awareness. That's the way to get to enlightenment. Build up more and more positive force, more and more deep awareness. That means doing it every day. And never giving up trying, or at least wishing to help anyone, no matter how difficult the person might be. Doesn't mean that we actively have to help them if we're not capable of it, but at least not giving up the wish to be able to help them. Not giving up on anybody. So these are the four. That if we have that, we will maintain the same in life, and we will not. It will not weaken. Any questions on that?
Yeah. I wonder. But we started with this strong commitment in the beginning.
Yeah.
If this having not commitment means there are emotions which are sort of struggling, strong commitment, and through practicing doesn't out stronger commitment by getting rid of this.
Right. Well, absolutely, that's correct. That he's saying that if we don't have this full commitment, then there are various disturbing emotions or things which are preventing that. But if we continue our practice, and presumably we're talking about bodhisattva type of practice, that these obstacles or blocks will weaken and our commitment will get stronger. Yes, that's why we, you know, start with a light version of this. We do start with, I don't know if it actually is possible to attain enlightenment, but it sounds pretty good. And if I could become like His Holiness, whether His Holiness is actually a Buddha or not, who am I to say? But if I could become like that, that would be really great. So I'm going to go in that direction and try to do like He does. And then as you build up more positive force by actually helping others, meditating, practicing, etc., and more deep awareness by various meditation methods for doing that, whether we do an analytical path or a path of, what shall we say, not so much emphasis on analysis, but trying to recognize the nature of the mind, etc. I mean, there are many different ways of meditating. But as we do more and more of that, then these blocks will get weaker. They'll get weaker. And our commitment can become stronger. Also, when you start to experience some of the benefits of bodhicitta, having bodhicitta, I mean, if you really have it, you won't get discouraged by anything. You really have it. You won't get depressed. You always are, have strong energy. Maybe you're old and your energy physically is weak, but you have, you know, this energy to go on. A lot of time, a lot of us, certainly myself included, you feel sort of what we call blah. You don't feel like doing anything. You don't have any energy to do anything, and you don't know what you want, then if you really have this strong bodhicitta, you'd be able to get over that very, very quickly, wouldn't you? And eventually that wouldn't even arise. But how would you get over that when you're in that state? I mean, you can do, it's very interesting. If you think of the various methods that you could use, you could do a, what are the causes for my feeling like this? You know, that type of analysis. You could do it as, this is just a wave of the Dharmakaya, to use our Kamakagyu friend's experience. That it's just a wave of the nature of the mind. You know, so no big deal, it'll settle down, it'll pass. There's no place where it can go. That way, you can do voidness meditation on it. Who is the person who is feeling like this, etc.? Or you could think about enlightenment and so many people that can be benefited by whatever efforts I can do. Now, if you don't get discouraged and feel overwhelmed, which of course is part of this bodhicitta commitment, not to feel overwhelmed or discouraged. You know, that's one of the points, not to ever get discouraged. Patience. That's why you need patience and perseverance. I think this is probably the strongest for overcoming this type of, I don't feel it like doing anything. And the example that is used the example that's used is, you know, the example that is used, of course, is that of if you have a headache or you're in a bad mood and you're living by yourself, you can just sit and do nothing or go to sleep. But if you have your young children who need to be fed and taken care of and so on, it doesn't matter how terrible you're feeling, you do it, you overcome it. So this is the example that's used of how strong a force is concern for others and wanting to take care of others, and doing it is. Well, these are some of the minor benefits of bodhicitta. There are much more. So if we're constantly striving, you know, you remind yourself all the time, this is what I'm trying to do. And when you are feeling low, remind yourself. Not just ceremonially, you know, ritualistically, three times in the morning, repeat a verse, and three times before you go to sleep, repeat a verse. Very easy to just get into that routine and think, well, I've kept all my commandments. Doesn't mean anything in terms of actually moving our hearts, does it? Do that for years and years, decades. And it just becomes a ritual. So,
pardon? You can even listen to the radio while you're doing
that. Right, you can listen to the radio while you're doing that. You could do all sorts of other things. Mentally wander at the same time. There are many things that you could do. Well, you go blah, blah, blah. Okay, now, the fifth training is, if we do this, this helps us not to separate from bodhicitta in our future lives. And this is a set of four contrasting modes of behavior. One thing that you stop and one thing that you do instead. So the first one is stop deceiving our gurus, parents, and the triple gem. Instead, always being honest with them, especially about our motivation and effort to help others. Not deceiving, being honest. I think, although it's not stated there, being honest with yourself. But in all the practices, we're calling forth the, you know, three gems, Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, etc. Hear my words. So this is, I think, what it's referring to when it says not deceiving the Buddhas and the triple gem. Then stop faulting and be contemptuous of bodhisattvas. You never tell who's a bodhisattva. Therefore, we regard everybody in a pure way as our teacher. That's a difficult one. That's a very difficult one. Not to criticize others, but to regard them as a teacher.
Boring life.
This is an interesting point. Can you give constructive criticism? I think yes. That's to help others. You have to be diplomatic, of course, in the way that you give it, in a way that others could accept. Could you constructively identify in your mind, you know, privately, what is faulty behavior in somebody else? Pardon?
With training, yes.
With training, you could, without getting angry or upset. I mean, very interesting. It's not easy. You know, I will confess, I had a very challenging situation the other day. I went to the barber shop to get a haircut, and there was this gentleman in front of me, you know, who was speaking with the barber and giving her a terrible time. He didn't speak German. He spoke in broken English. That wasn't his native language either. And he had a cell phone, and he was showing her all sorts of pictures of what he wanted. And then he was criticizing everything that she was doing, you know, in terms of his hair. And, you know, this little square centimeters over here, that should be shorter, and it wasn't good enough. He was taking forever. And in my mind, I was very critical of this guy, and amazed at the patience of the barber. You know, this poor young woman who, you know, just basically took it all. And actually, I had another appointment. I couldn't stay. But also, I really didn't want to just sit there and continually, you know, come on already. Type of thing. And so I left and I came back later. But that's an illustration of a few things. One is in the 37 Bodhisattva practices, where it says that if being in a situation is just going to cause your anger or attachment to increase, it's best to leave. Can't handle it. Mm-hmm. So I left. Because I could see the danger that I was starting to have quite negative thoughts about this man. But that's the challenge. Yeah, that's the challenge. You know, come on, it's just your hair. I didn't have very much hair either, so you know what? So he has to be very careful. But the thing is, can you just think, you know, wow, this guy is really being outrageous, and I, you know, what this? He's my teacher, not just my teacher of patience. But, you know, I rejoice in the patience of the barber, and I realize that this is somebody, you know, this is the type of behavior that I really would want to avoid in myself. And this poor man is so involved with attachment to himself and what he looks like and ordering people around without caring at all about the other person that, you know, this is quite sad for him.
One of the situations when they say in the Bhagavatam, become like a piece of wood. This is
right, yeah. I mean, that's the other thing, to become like a piece of wood, like it says in Bodhicharyavatara, but that means don't have negative thoughts. It doesn't mean, you know, that's not talking just about don't get up and tell the guy, you know, come on, you know, or you're taking, there's a whole, because there are a lot of other people waiting.
But is that also not possible to just say, you know, come on?
To say to the guy, come on, is that possible?
Depends on the organization.
I don't know. In that situation, that would be considered, I don't know, that's
and
too difficult.
Doing it without disturbing emotions.
To do that without disturbing emotions would be. But when I went back a little bit later, I congratulated the barber. I sympathized with her about how difficult this guy was, and I congratulated her on her patience.
What she said?
And I think she appreciated it. I think she appreciated it. So, anyway. Regard others, stop faulting or be contemptuous of bodhisattvas. So whether this guy was a bodhisattva, I don't know, but the point being...
Hopefully not for you.
Hopefully not, but just being, what should we say, very careful in terms of criticism.
Yeah, but didn't you left him the chance to have some, you know... Someone who is, you know, giving him a hint how he's reacting? I mean...
Behaving.
Well, to, you know, he's saying, would it be helpful to the guy to give him a hint or indication of how he's behaving? I don't know whether or not... First of all, I don't know the guy. Complete stranger. There was undoubtedly a lot of projection on my part. Mm-hmm. Of who he was, what his life, you know, was like, or I have no idea. I think that's very dangerous to interfere in that type of situation. I think Shantideva's remain like a block of wood is quite appropriate in this thing. He wasn't hurting her. If he were hurting her, that's something else. You know, if he were hitting her because, you know, she 1 millimeter too much, she cut off. That's something else. Mind you, I projected and imagined that he would do that. But
yeah, I agree with you, but only if you are probably on a higher level. So
yeah.
Yes. Avoidance, you know,
I'm seeing it on a very
I think that,
lively level. No, and saying to someone, come on. somehow you are more in this situation.
You do us.
Yeah, but I think that the guy would have gotten very, very angry and put on a scene.
Barbara, but I see other situations which is similar, you know, where people just not reacting, you know, adequate to the other person. So why not say, come on? You can have also humor, maybe make it, you know, in a humorous way a little bit.
Well, I don't think so. This guy wasn't. This guy wasn't. It didn't look as though he was in the mood for humor.
Okay.
Not at all. Not at all. It was clear. I mean, I don't want to get into details of, you know, where the guy came from and all of that. But in any case, let's leave it. The next one is, we stop causing others to regret anything positive or constructive they have done, like your peace walk. You don't want to discourage them. Instead, we encourage others to be constructive and helpful if they're receptive. So, somebody has been doing something that is positive or constructive, you know, don't get them to regret it. You know, it's very good. It might have been a little bit pointless, might not have done, you know, the great effect, but you were trying, and even if your motivation was not terribly pure, you were trying, you know. So, your peace walk. And then the last one, stop being hypocritical and pretentious, you know, dealing with others. In other words, hiding our faults and pretending to have qualities we lack. Instead, always be honest and frank about our limitations and abilities. Very cruel to promise more than we can deliver, raising others' false hopes. Questions on these? So that takes quite a lot to be able to be honest with others about ourselves and to admit our weaknesses. Now, do you admit your weaknesses to just everybody? What about to somebody who is going to be very cruel and take advantage of it? You have to be skillful. You know, you don't pretend to have qualities that you don't have. You don't hide your weaknesses, but that doesn't mean that you have to advertise your weaknesses, does it? Not in all situations. What do you think?
I mean, it means to be honest to yourself. That's you think about other people, what you described, then I think this is the most important.
Right. That we don't deceive ourselves. This is very important. I mean, that was the point that we had earlier for lifetime, that we don't deceive others. But,
my experience is that when you start to share your weaknesses, that is really strong. The people don't know. Everybody has our limitations, and people really are very, very reactive to that, you know, to sharing your weaknesses.
Right, so he says that people have respond favorably when you share your weaknesses, but there are those that are quite sadistic, and if you reveal what your weak point is, then they know where to attack you. Many people are quite sadistic, and many people are in sort of a sadomasochistic type of, doesn't have to be the extreme of leather and chains, but, you know, there are many relationships in which the one partner is verbally abusive of the other partner, and the other partner just is always quiet and takes it. And if that partner, you know, reveals what it is that will hurt him or her the most, then the sadistic one will always, you know, push the button, as they say. So all these things have to be understood, you know, in a certain way. What about with your children? Do you pretend to be able to fix everything and to do everything when you can't? Do you hide your weaknesses? Let's say you are in a dangerous situation with a small child, 4-year-old child, and, you know, all sorts of violence is going on around, and the child is very frightened. Do you tell the child, I'm frightened too? Or do you tell the child, it's going to be okay? Don't be scared. What do you do? Pardon?
The second,
obviously. You don't tell the child, I'm just scared as well. So is this hiding your faults? It's a good motivation, right?
To
protect the child. So all of these things have to be applied with some wisdom, some discrimination. But I think you're right in terms of the emphasis is not to fool yourself. Think that I have qualities that I don't have and so on. You know, this is what I always call the great white guru trip. To pretend I'm so holy, I'm so great, and so on.
The spiritual path is very important to show your weakness. If you have a good teacher, and you let him work on you, then you really grow.
Right, so if when we're on the spiritual path and we have a good teacher and we show our weaknesses or reveal our weaknesses to the teacher, then the teacher will work with us to overcome that. Well, this is true if we have a really qualified teacher and if we ourselves are qualified so that we're not going to get angry with the teacher when the teacher tries to help us to overcome this. So that's part of the unspoken contract of the entrusting yourself to a spiritual teacher. And there's a third point. Anyway, the teacher is qualified. The teacher isn't going to abuse us. This is very important. And we have a personal relation. That's the third point. Very few people actually have that really close relationship that the teacher will work with them on their own individual problems, their own individual issues. Usually, teacher gives teachings to a group of people and you work on it yourself. That's the style. And often the method that the teachers use, and again, this is why you have to have this special commitment to the teacher, is that they will mirror your problems to show you, in a sense, how absurd you are. But then, of course, you know, you could accuse them of having that problem. So you have to, again, as it says here, not criticize, but see them as a bodhisattva trying to teach us.
Can I tell an anecdote with you?
Can you tell a what?
I want to tell an anecdote with
an
you.
An anecdote.
I was by His Holy the Dalai Lama one time, and then I was hysterically crazy with my mouth and everything. And then Alex came with his mouth and with his face, and he made me such a with a face like. And I saw him, and immediately was really like for me was a great teaching. Because sure, I am so
right.
But he really showed me really in front, and I. Until today, I thank so much because now I am a little bit more aware how I grew up with the teacher.
Right, so she, I don't know if that got recorded, but what she was saying then is that I was with her once with in the presence of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and she had her mouth wide open and an incredible expression on her face. And I mirrored that and imitated what she looked like to her. And it caused her to realize that she looked pretty funny. To calm down a little bit. So anyway, these are some examples. Okay, so that brings us, I think, to the end. And next time, then we'll actually get into the Bodhisattva vows. Remember, we had said we don't want the Bodhisattva vows section to take a couple months. So let's try to go through this at a reasonable pace, okay? Good. Now let's end with the dedication. We think whatever understanding, whatever positive forces come from this may go deeper and deeper and act as a cause to reach enlightenment for the benefit of all. Thank you.